Well, with a topic like this, there are a lot of different directions one can go, and so perhaps what I should share with you first of all is the directions that we'll head here, and I'm just going to carve out pieces of this overall topic. Really four sections. We'll start with a brief view of the role of soil testing in the future, now and in the future, a history of soil sampling and testing in the U.S., with most of, really an emphasis on the sampling end. International soil testing and some issues there, and then we'll wrap up with a discussion on what I guess I see as some soil testing problems that over the years we've sort of set up on the shelf. So let's get started with the role of soil testing. I want to start with this diagram that depicts some underlying factors for the challenges of the coming decades. And I guess as I think about this, I see maybe three big factors. One, of course, is human nutrition, for obvious reasons. Another one is carbon and all the various aspects of carbon. And then another one is land in a very rather large viewpoint that includes soil quality, land use, water quality, et cetera. Henry Janssen at the International Soil Organic Matter Symposium this summer pointed out in rather astutely that the intersection of carbon and land was surprisingly soil organic matter, and that he thought that was a pretty important point to realize. And so all of a sudden our soil organic matter scientists are sort of in the limelight when you think of those issues. Well, I would take this a little further and ask you to think about the triangle that represents the intersection of all three of those and suggest that soil fertility and soil testing plays a very critical role where those three factors come together as we look to the future. Also, I want to again call your attention to what we call the 4R nutrient stewardship framework, especially those performance indicators around the outside of that circle. And then I'll ask you to think about those that soil testing plays a role with. And if you think about it, there are a lot of those system performance indicators that soil testing gives you a lot of information about. And so the whole point of this is that, yeah, soil testing has been important, and I think it's going to continue to be important in the future, but we do have some problems to work on, and some of the papers to come later in this session will be addressing some of those. Okay, let's start with our second section on history. I'll start with this graph of fertilizer consumption in the U.S. because often what we see is that the development of soil testing, at least laboratory soil testing, evolved in a similar way to the evolution of fertilizer use. Now, if I could back up, kind of keep that picture in mind and the grand period of growth there over the 60s and early 70s, and then let's look at this best estimate of soil sampling in the U.S. from a period of 1955 to 2005. And this comes from a couple of different sources. One, a publication that Ted Peck, who many of you knew very well from the University of Illinois, published. And then we've tried to come up with an estimate of current soil testing, that is 2005, through our soil test summary. And what we've done is tried to estimate what labs we were missing and trying to come up with about some crude estimate of the sample volume that we missed in our summary. And we do that, we come up with about 4.1 million samples that we're estimating are being in use today. So when we look at this graph, it's kind of an odd one because you see this period of time in here where there's this huge increase in volume of testing from 1.2 million samples to 3.7, and then a turnaround, and we lost much of what we had in soil testing. And then since that period of time, you can see that we've been actually growing soil testing, soil sampling, by a rate of about 55,000 samples a year during that period. That's in terms of 2005 volume, that's a 1.3% increase per year, which isn't too bad. I mean, you could say, well, it should be better, but I mean, those of you that think statistically would say, well, that's one point compared to another point, but, there's some uncertainty. But it does, it could be off a bit, but that's about been the growth rate. Now, say, well, what's happening here? Why did this behave the way it has? And that's what I want to address for a little bit. One of the ways we can do that is by separating public testing from private testing. And you see the blue data points here being the public labs. And actually, if you look from across really about a 30-year period there, you see public testing came in at about 1.5 million samples. Pretty stable during that period. It bounced around a little bit, but about 1.5 million. And then since about 1985, again with this estimate down here, it looks like we have lost public sampling. And of course, that's coming from two things, maybe fewer samples per lab and a lot fewer labs being operated in the public sector. And so what that says is that the majority of this dynamics over this period of time occurred because of what was happening in the private sector. So let's dig into that a little deeper. And here I've brought up the sum of P plus K fertilizer sales and put it on the same slide as the total volume of samples. And what we're going to do now is first of all remind ourselves that soil testing, that grand period of soil testing growth, was occurring at about the same time that we had that grand period of fertilizer growth. And then let's launch into this curious pyramid that happened inverted V that occurred there during a 20-year period, 10 years of growth and then 10 years of reduction. And these aren't my observations. These are observations from Ted Peck from a paper he published back in 1990. He talks about exuberant expectations of the Green Revolution being part of that growth period, oil company expansion into agriculture, agronomists from fertilizer companies, testing labs, extension, all working together saying the same thing and promoting soil testing through educational programs. And you can see, boy, it really was effective. So then, if that was so effective in increasing, what happened at this point here in about 1966, 67? Well, sort of the opposite. Fertilizer profit margins narrowed markedly. Education programs and agronomy positions were reduced during that period. And also we saw the rates, fertilizer rates, getting up to the point where soil P and K levels were climbing, and climbing rather rapidly. And we are still actually experiencing some of the benefit of that banked P and K today as we look at some fairly negative budgets across a good portion of the Corn Belt. So a fair bit of dynamics there. Now, part of that growth that we've been seeing is undoubtedly due to the advent of precision agriculture. So I try to go back and pull out some precision ag numbers, and these are data that many of you have probably seen before. They come out of the Precision Ag Survey that Crop Life and Purdue does periodically. And the top line here is the GPS soil sampling. You'll see an increasing trend of the soil sampling by GPS as precision ag technologies have been offered to a greater and greater extent by retail outlets around the country. And if we take one lab as an example, John, we'll take AgVice from Benson, some data that they've shared with me. If you look 2008 versus 2000, what they will show is a 46% increase in total soil samples, but a 62% increase in grid or zone soil sampling. And so grid soil sampling has been increasing faster than the total. It's a higher percentage now than it was years ago. So precision ag has contributed positively, I think, to the growth of soil testing. Okay, part three. Trying to develop some international perspective on soil sampling. And we're going to do that in two ways, or three ways, really. We're going to look at sample volume by some selected countries. Then we're going to look at sampling intensity by those same countries. And then just some issues that are occurring in those various countries. So first on sample volume. What you see here is the samples per year in millions for Argentina, Australia, Brazil, China, India, Russia, and the U.S. And then what I've attempted to do is pull out from these countries data from the 1980s and data from the 2000s. So if you want to, in your head, kind of think 1985 versus 2005 over a 20-year period, not exactly those years, but that kind of helps us get a sense. So we're trying to look at the growth in sample volume over time. It's kind of interesting. Who has the most sampling going on? It's not the U.S. It's India, according to these numbers. And that's for 2005. It wasn't like we could not get data for India in 1985. So we're not sure where they were at that point. If you look across most of those countries, you see some growth. Except for Russia, you see a reduction there for reasons I think that we all understand due to the political changes that occurred there during a period of time. Now, if we go up and look at intensity, and I need to explain these numbers because they're a little bit sensitive, especially to the controlled economies represented on this map. This is not sampling protocol we're looking at here. This is a reflection of the significance of soil testing, of soil sampling in nutrient management in those countries. And so don't think these are recommendations for how many hectares a sample should represent. This is just total hectares of crop land, in some cases crop and managed pastures, versus the number of samples that are being tested in those countries, or an estimate of those samples. And when you look at that in the 1980s, first of all, you'll see Argentina comes in there at 1620 hectares per sample. Soil testing was just getting started in the mid-80s in Argentina. That's what that says. Australia, not a lot. I mean, that's a pretty high number there as well. And then these other countries were running between 32 and 72 hectares per sample. Okay. Then let's look at the 2005, and the country that really made progress was Argentina. Sampling there has really taken off. That agriculture has really taken off. We'll talk more about that later. Good progress in Australia, Brazil, China, India, the others. Some progress, but not quite as much. Again, Russia went backwards a bit during that period of time. Now I want to go back to India though, because it illustrates a real challenge that we have for soil testing as a diagnostic tool. We think, well, India, it looks pretty impressive on these numbers. But then let's look at ag holdings per sample. In the U.S., these data would suggest we have a half a holding per sample. So in other words, if you just do the arithmetic, it's two samples per farm on the average is what we're getting, okay? India, 22 holdings per sample. So what's happening? You got all these small farms, these very small holders, and how does soil testing fit into that kind of environment? It doesn't fit very well. And so even though their intensity looks pretty high, they've got some real problems, and we'll talk about those in this next section on issues and perspectives. We'll start with Argentina. This comes from Dr. Garcia. He says, in recent increases, and here he's talking about the last couple years, soil testing is taking off in Argentina, a very positive sign. Several new large labs, additional ones are needed, he says. And that's in spite of the cost there being 2 to 3 times higher than it is here in the U.S. Still, their farmers and dealers and crop advisors are investing in soil testing. Also, they've just launched this last month, actually, a national soil testing proficiency program. Also, they're in the process of setting up a certified crop advisor program in Argentina. So a lot of positive things happening in Argentina. We look at Australia. This comes from Dr. Norton. Pasture sampling is significant. He asked me to point that out to you, that they do sample a lot of pastures there, which is not something I think we do probably a whole lot of in the U.S. Drought over most of a decade has, he says, reduced significantly the amount of testing that's going on there. You can see how that could happen. Two main labs do most of the soil testing. That's quite different, especially if you think of India again, where they've got close to 700 or so soil testing labs across that country. Considering conducting a soil test summary similar to what we have been doing periodically here in the U.S. So they feel like they want better data on the volume of soil testing there. Dr. Proshnoff from Brazil, is very proud of their ion exchange resin testing that they do there. That's kind of a unique aspect in Brazil. Not so much the work on resins. A lot of places have worked on resins, but what they've done in Brazil is work the resin into the service laboratory environment. They've automated it. If you ever get a chance, look at some of those laboratories. They've figured out how to do resins on massive numbers of samples, and they're pretty confident that it does a good job for them. And if you look at the calibration, the data in the literature, of course, usually resins come out at least as good, if not better, than our normal extractions. 5 regional laboratory quality control programs there in place, 5, and they have massive number of samples of laboratories contributing to each of those regional programs. And so that seems to be moving again in the right direction. Sampling and interpretation in no-till is a concern, and we're going to have a paper on that later on today. In China, Dr. Jin says nearly all soil testing is through government-supported programs there, consisting of general periodic surveys over a 4 to 5 year period. They're currently conducting their third survey. that will run 2005 through 2009. So this one is underway, and those data that I shared with you earlier, that's sort of a projected estimate for this last period. Strong government support for expanding soil testing activity, including strong financial support of getting more soil testing established, getting more soil testing done in China. Then we come to India. A very interesting story there for soil testing. Dr. Majumdar complains about how inadequate soil testing infrastructure is in India. And in fact, to illustrate the point, he says that if they had all their laboratories running at full capacity, it would take them 17 years to analyze one sample from each holding. And so, a challenge. When you have 119 million holdings to deal with, I mean, there's a challenge for soil testing. Government thrust to increase number of labs is ongoing. Most labs can only test primary nutrient budgets, though they have a number of research projects that show substantial deficiencies to sulfur in a number of micronutrients. So they're trying to figure out how do we deal with that need, and then some concern over the quality of sampling and analysis. You've got all these labs, and there's questions about the quality coming from many of them. Russia. Dr. Ivanova, in general, soil testing is conducted by a network of labs, 107 centers and stations funded by the government, again during five-year rounds, with the first one starting in 1970. There's been some talk about privatization of labs, but currently the Ministry of Ag leads and coordinates agricultural land monitoring, including soil testing. Recently, soil sampling services are being offered by large fertilizer producers, but soil testing is still generally done by the government labs in Russia. Part four, we're going to talk about maybe some problems on the shelf in soil testing. And to start this, I want to go back to an old publication and an old term, and that term is paradigm. I guess the one that introduced me to that word was actually Joel Barker in his book Future Edge. Some of you might have read that a number of years ago. In it, he defines what a paradigm is, and he defines it as a set of rules and regulations, written or unwritten, that establishes or defines boundaries and tells you how to behave inside the boundaries in order to be, in quotes, successful with that paradigm. So now let's apply that to soil testing and think about what is our soil testing paradigm. Now, there's probably an image that's a little different that appears to all of us, but what comes to my mind are three layers, with the central layer being the soil testing practice, actually doing soil testing, sampling, handling, analysis, and interpretation and delivery. As a foundation supporting that practice, there's a bunch of soil testing research that we benefit a great deal from in this country on sampling procedures, methods and automation, quality control, correlation and calibration. And then you have another layer, I think, that I'm just calling infrastructure that includes education and training, marketing and promotion, government policy, perhaps, and some oversight of the industry, okay? You've got your own vision of the paradigm, but that's my vision of the paradigm. And so then we're going to go back to Barker in his book and pick up on a couple of additional quotes where he says, sooner or later, every paradigm begins to develop a very special set of problems that everyone in the field wants to be able to solve, and no one has a clue as to how to do it. So what do? Up on the shelf it goes. Unsolved problems are put aside, up on a shelf, so to speak, and we make a promise to ourselves, we're going to get back to that sometime, but I don't have time to deal with it right now because I don't really know what to do with it. So we put it on the shelf. And so now the next logical place direction for us to go is to think about what problems are on the shelf. And the one that I always think of when I think about, what aren't we doing right in soil testing? You know, it's potassium. We'd learned a long time ago that drying a sample really causes havoc with ammonium acetate extractable K. We know we lose a lot of predictability when we dry the soil. And we know that drying is a sensitive process. And we've all talked about that. But largely, what do? We dry soils, we run exchangeable K on them. We put that problem on the shelf. Never really addressed it. And then you can see several other items that I've listed there, some of which will be addressed later on in this session. The only one I'm really going to, and you would have your own set of problems, and you might disagree with some of these that I've listed here. The idea is just to get you thinking about problems that we've put on the shelf and how we might get them off the shelf. Or guess what happens? We come up with a different paradigm. And that takes us to the last bullet here. Farmer access to reliable and affordable laboratory services. Now, he says, well, that's not a problem for us. Maybe not be a problem for us here, but believe me, it's a big problem in other parts of the world, especially in developing countries. And so now we look at, well, what happens then in those areas? Well, a paradigm shift occurs, and something comes in and replaces the void that isn't being filled by our traditional approach to soil testing. And one of the things that we're seeing happening in Southeast Asia and in Central America is the omission plot. And there's a whole story behind this that I don't have time to share with you right now, but basically what they've done is they developed, and IRI has been involved in this, in rice in Southeast Asia, various organizations are involved in Central America in this, but the omission plot is used to determine indigenous nutrient supply when other nutrients are non-limiting, and then the approximate rate to apply to correct the deficiency. And you can get to rate via some steps in there. You can get to rate with these very simple designs. You have to make some assumptions, but you get to a point that's a better point than you have without the approach. Remember, you don't have soil testing you rely on. In fact, in these areas, soil testing is really a research tool to assist in defining domains. What's relevant for that particular set of omission plots? Now, what I also find interesting is to look in my own backyard and see the same concept of omission plots showing up in the realm of precision agriculture. Here's an illustration right here of a project. Now, we don't call them omission plots here. We call it a delta yield approach to determining nitrogen recommendations. But within the realm of precision ag, this makes a fair bit of sense. And so I find it interesting that in our advanced agriculture, we see some of the same things sneaking out of our nutrient management programs that are coming out in the lesser developed parts of the world. But it's the same kind of a practice. All right, some questions for you. First one, should we expect soil testing to be the one tool to do it all? That is a real knife, by the way. That does exist. Or a tool providing input to be integrated with other nutrient management information? Can plant and soil-based approaches, like we see appearing in Central America and other parts of the world, can plant and soil-based approaches be more fully integrated? Is it time for us to figure out a way to take the sensors and the soil analyses and do a better job of actually systematically pulling that information together? And then it comes to adaptive management. And I've used this slide before this week. I apologize for those of you that heard me speak on this twice now, but I do believe in adaptive management and in tools designed to accept the concept of adaptive management. So we look at a set of site factors that influence optimum nutrient rates. And you see soil factors as one of a whole bunch of things that can influence the decision-making process, that integrate into a decision support mechanism of some sort that generates an output, and a decision is made, an action, an outcome, and then you can come back and feedback loop, and you go in and you tweak that decision support process. But the whole point here is to figure out a way to better integrate soil test information with all that other site data. So to summarize, four bullets. First, assessment of soil fertility status and change is a critical need for addressing current, and I truly believe, future challenges. Soil testing is growing in the U.S. and several developing countries, but is simply not functional in others for a lot of rather solid reasons. They're going to be very hard to do anything about, and so we shift things a bit. Numerous soil testing problems are sitting on the shelf that in some cases are resulting in a paradigm shift in nutrient management decision support. So we have just a couple of alternatives. Either remove the problem from the shelf or a different paradigm takes over. And finally, more systematic integration of soil test information with other site factors influencing nutrient decisions could add value to soil test data, in my mind. And we talk a lot about those other factors this week. What we need is a little better pulling together integration of all this knowledge that we have in this discipline, and to put it in place at the point of the decision, where the decision is made on the farm and with the advisors that are working with the growers. So with that, I thank you much for allowing me to pontificate a little bit and share some data from around the world. So, thank you.